Sarah, John Hannigan, Dale, and Bill. Am I missing anyone?
And Tom and Kathy at NOFA.
Oh, hi.
Hi, buddy. Hi.
How did your big evening go?
It was terrific. Thank you so much. It was really great. Quite a success.
Yeah, it really was. And Dr. Kube and Dr. Warren Ken joined us, and Peggy Murray from NIAAA. It was terrific.
That's great.
Good, good. Okay, well, I think one more. Or I don't know if we've lost someone, or we have a couple more joined us.
Hi, Dan.
Michael Charnas.
Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jen. Michael Charnas, too. How are you?
Oh, hi, Michael. Good. I didn't know you'd be joining us today.
I left my meeting.
Ah. Okay, well, we'll go ahead and start with the Sarah's presentation on the WebEx. Is everyone able to log on to WebEx?
Yeah.
So,
mine is loading 1% per 4 seconds, so I'll.
Okay. Sarah, are you ready to go?
I'm ready. I'm clicking share my desktop, so hopefully that works. Okay, can you see my slides?
I see your slides.
Yes.
Okay. Michael, I'll be done probably before you finish loading. So
I'm up to 58%. This is.
I'll speak slowly. So I am just going to give you guys an update on what we're working on currently. So the specific aim that I'm going to be talking about is addressing the role of age on neurobehavioral functioning. So one of our key questions in the previous phases of CFAS, we had an older age range than we have now. And so one of our key questions in CFAS 3 was, were the findings that we have seen previously, do they apply also to our younger age group, which is 5 to 7 years of age? And so I do want to stress that these are definitely works in progress. And so any suggestions or input you have, I'd be happy to take. So these are our two studies that I'm going to talk about today. They both focus on age. The first one is more of an overall assessment of cognition, problem behaviors, and adaptive behavior. And again, the key thing that we were looking at was age, comparing our two age groups, but we threw sex in there because we could, because we have a huge sample. And then the second study is specifically between age and disruptive behavior, which is one of our problem behaviors, but it's from a different measure. Okay, so the first study is our overall assessment where we're looking at general neuropsychological function, both problem behaviors and adaptive behavior. We know from the work of CFAS, but also from many, many other studies, that prenatal alcohol exposure is associated with deficits in all of these areas. But the effect of age specifically has not been very well studied. And again, as I said, we were interested in applying our previous work to our younger age group. And so we hypothesized that prenatal alcohol exposure would result in greater deficits in older than younger children, and that's really based on anecdotal information. Our hypothesis was based on anecdotal information, and we also thought that we would not see the typical sex differences in cognition that have been reported in typical development.
That's based on earlier work.
Okay, I have an echo.
Yep.
Yes. Why?
Jill, do you have any suggestions?
Maybe someone.
Are you on speaker? I am not on speaker. Is somebody else?
Somebody else on? Yeah, maybe someone else is on speaker.
I don't see anyone else clicking, but if I mute you, it's because it looks like you're the interference. I apologize. Are you going to mute me?
No, you're not hearing the echo right now.
Okay. Yeah, okay, no echo at all. All right, thank you. Okay, so we thought that the sex differences that have been reported in typical cognition would not be apparent in alcohol-exposed children. So this is exclusively based on CFAS-3 data, so I'm really very, very excited to say that we have over 300 children that have been tested so far in phase 3. The average age of the cohort altogether was around 11 years. But we split them into our two age groups, which is 5 to 7 and 10 to 16, and, of course, alcohol exposure versus control. We looked at general cognition using a pretty broad battery, looking at general intellectual function, and then of various, I'm not going to go into the details of the different measures, but we had two broad measures. Then we used the child behavior checklist, which is a parent rating of problem behaviors. So it's a questionnaire. We've used it before. And then the Vineland, which is our adaptive functioning measure, which is also a questionnaire completed by the parents. We analyzed the data with age and sex and exposure as factors. So this is just our demographic information. I think you can probably see my cursor. So just to orient you, we've got children 5 to 7 and then adolescents 10 to 16 in both our alcohol exposed and our control samples. So we have 151 alcohol exposed and 175 controls overall. And you can see, obviously, the younger children are younger than the older children, as they should be. And these are the breakdown down here. We have the breakdown by sites if you're interested in that. We did not include in this original or in our first pass analysis, we looked at site as a factor and it wasn't, you know, it really wasn't significant, so we didn't include it. But in our formal analyses, we'll report that. I didn't include it here just to make it more simple. Okay, so again, we analyzed in an overall MANOVA with alcohol exposure, age, and sex as factors. We found, as we, of course, expected, that alcohol exposure resulted in poorer neuropsychological functioning, more problem behaviors, and worse adaptive functioning. That's not a surprise, and that wasn't really the aim of our study. What we were really interested in is this row here, the age effects. And it's not quite as clean as we would like it to be at this point. So we have no age effects on psychopathology, meaning that younger children and older children are showing the same group difference or the same levels of problem behaviors, and it's not a factor on the CVCL. On the Vineland, we do see a pretty clear age effect that the adolescents are performing worse. They have more adaptive problems than the children, so A is adolescent and C is children, on two of the three Vineland scales. But when we look at the neuropsychological functioning, overall age is a significant finding, but it's only significant on follow-up on two measures, two of our subtests out of, 12 or 15 maybe, and they're in the opposite directions. So on one measure, adolescents are worsened children, and on the other measure, this is word fluency, adolescents are worse than are better than children. So it's not very clear. Sex was also not entirely clear because it's inconsistent as well. No sex differences on adaptive functioning. Males are worse than females on somatic problems, somatic complaints, and females are worse than males on our anxious and depressed scales, which is not entirely surprising because we, in the general population, you expect females to have greater problems in this area than males. However, it's standardized by sex, so it turns out to be surprising. So we have no interactions with age, sex, and group. Which just makes it easier to explain. So again, you know, the group effect is not surprising, but very clear. But the age and sex effects are not that straightforward at this point.
All right, can I ask a question?
Sure.
So there's no difference between groups on the age effects. So it's whether you're exposed or not, you have those effects. Is that
there's no So are you asking about the interaction?
Yeah.
No group. There's no relationship between group and age.
For psychopathology or adaptive functioning.
Right.
Okay.
Okay. So just to wrap up the first study, we saw, of course, that alcohol exposure resulted in deficits. We're not surprised at that. Our primary interest was in age, and for the most part, I would have to say that age was not an overwhelmingly significant effect, which is not what we expected. We thought that older children would have more problems than younger children, but at the same time, it also tells us that these problems, A, persist, So young children and old children have the same degree of deficits, but also that they're apparent in the younger age. You know, we originally, in CFAS anyway, only looked at the older age, and now we're showing in a CFAS population that those same deficits are being reported or are being, we can document them in our younger 5 to 7 year olds. One thing that I think was clinically useful is that in spite of the fact that overall age doesn't really affect cognition, adaptive behavior is worsening with age. Even though the test is standardized by age, alcohol or overall the groups seem to get worse, but it's in both groups, to get at what Elizabeth was asking. Both groups are worse as teenagers. Sex was not an overwhelmingly important factor. We, again, as I said, this is a preliminary stab at these analyses. We definitely need to examine them further. But I think the overall message is that age and sex are not hugely important in these analyses, and they definitely don't compare in magnitude to the effects of prenatal alcohol exposure. So that's really our important finding. And in terms of our bigger picture of CFAS and the neurobehavioral project, if our results continue to hold, that there are few age and sex effects, it makes our refining of our neurobehavioral profile, and it makes it an easier job for us because we don't have to consider age and sex in our profile. Okay, so I'm going to move on to the second study.
Sarah?
Yeah?
Real quick, just wondering, how long does it take to administer these questionnaires?
Well, we have a series of questions. Those two questionnaires take about 20 minutes each. So 40 minutes for those two questionnaires.
Sarah, can I ask another question?
Yeah, of course.
So does it seem odd to you, given that the Vineland is age, you know, standardized, that the adolescents are actually in the control group are actually doing worse than the children?
Yeah, that's a good point. Yes, and I don't know how it could be. I mean, the test, it is a newer version. It's not the original Vineland, so it has been restandardized. So I don't think that it's just the fact that the test might be older. And it may just be, you know, that parents of teenagers are reporting more problems overall. But we've discussed that, and I don't have a good answer for that, why we're not matching our standardization.
Yeah, because that's where you would expect an age-by-group interaction.
Right. But we're seeing the same decreases in our controls.
Have you, like, plotted it to kind of see what it looks like by group? Like a scatter plot of some kind to just kind of try to see what's going on?
Yep. Yeah, and we have done that.
What does it look like?
Pretty consistent. I don't have it here, so I can't show it to you, but it's pretty consistent. You know, both groups are getting worse. It's lines are pretty parallel. But we need to do one thing that we're working on right now is examining for outliers. So, you know, it's possible that will change our results. But we've seen this before in previous studies using the Vineland where there's an overall age effect. In some of our studies, we've shown age by group. But we're not showing that here in a much larger sample than we've reported before.
But it just makes me wonder if there is really an interaction that the Vineland is not good enough to capture. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Because if you're in a normative sample, you shouldn't get worse over time.
Right.
So it makes me wonder if we should conclude not that there is no interaction, but that the measure itself is not capable.
I was going to say that it's not sensitive enough, but really it's actually being more sensitive to problems in the teenagers. But I completely agree with you. I think that that would be something that we would need to address, that it's being, that we're showing this in both of our, you know, exposed and unexposed sample. And that's the benefit of having a control group, right? Because if we didn't have a control group, kids with alcohol exposure were getting worse with age, but really they're not getting any more worse than anybody else.
Yeah.
Sarah?
Oh, who wants to go?
Go ahead. you go first.
All right, Sarah. In the younger group, were there any of the tests in your 12 or 15 group battery that were more sensitive or better able to discriminate the alcohol exposed group than others?
Yeah, I understand what you're asking. I don't think I know off the top of my head. So what we would do to address that question would be to look at effect sizes separated by group to see if there were some measures that were better at the younger age, had larger effect sizes for that group difference than in the older age. Is that right?
Yeah, and the thought was, going back to Tom's question, was that if there was a subset of this screening that could be, you know, had that utility and maybe could be developed as a quick screening tool,
right.
That could lead to larger, you know, investigations if it was positive. That's what I was wondering about.
Yeah, I agree, and that's what we have done in the previous phases is we've tried to pull out individual measures that had the largest effect sizes.
Right.
And that's definitely what we would do here because that's our goal is to get that brief screener that's our biggest goal is to get that brief screener that we can use to better identify alcohol-exposed kids.
Okay. It'll be interesting to see that when you have it.
Yep.
Thanks.
And, Sarah, this is Kathy Mitchell. Hi, how are you?
Hi.
Hi. So I just have a question with the rationale looking at prenatal alcohol exposure being associated with increases in disruptive behavior. So, and I just missed one small part of your intro, so maybe I missed this. Did your research or the kids that were included, were you able to tease out any environmental influences, or did you just include children that had a history of disruptive behaviors? Do you understand what I'm getting at? I mean, I think that we see disruptive behaviors only in some of the children with FASD. We don't see that as an overall behavior. So I'm wondering if you were just looking at children with histories of disruptive behaviors to begin with, or if you were able to tease out any environmental influences.
That's a great question, Kathy. So the second study that I'm about to talk about is specifically about disruptive behaviors. The first one was about behavior problems more generally. But to answer your specific question, we haven't pulled out just the kids who have elevated ratings of disruptive behaviors. I think that would be definitely a useful test to do, to pull out the ones who come up positive for disruptive behaviors and then try to look at what are the factors, or I guess we would compare them, kids with disruptive behaviors to kids without disruptive behaviors, and compare various environmental factors to see if we could come up with factors that predict the presence of disruptive behaviors. I think that's an interesting question, but it's not what we
do. Yeah. Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Yep. So the second study is specifically looking at disruptive behaviors. So this is a subset of the problem behaviors, although it's being measured by a different question, but it's also a parent questionnaire. And disruptive behaviors are useful to look at because studies have shown that they're predictive of future problems, and they are something that's been reported as elevated in kids with histories of heavy prenatal alcohol exposure. So, again, what we were interested in is how age interacts with alcohol exposure and whether the same elevations in disruptive behaviors that we've seen in our older samples apply also to younger samples. And further, we wanted to know whether we could use disruptive behaviors to specifically identify alcohol-exposed subjects. So in this study, we actually included three groups. We had our alcohol-exposed sample, controls, and our contrast group. And in CFAS-3, contrast means children who were recruited because they had a report of behavior problems, so their parents were concerned about them. They don't necessarily have a specific diagnosis, but they might have had a specific diagnosis, but they came to us because their parents were concerned about their behavior. And we had the parents complete this disruptive behavior rating scale, which I'll show you in a minute. There are four classifications. We considered a rating of pretty much or very much to be indicative of a disruptive behavior. And then we analyzed by age group and group. So this is, it's very small. You don't have to read it, but this is the survey. It's 45 questions, and the parent responds, my child does not do this at all, just a little, pretty much, or very much. So the first one is interrupts or intrudes on others. And so there's 45 of those, and it takes, 10 to 15 minutes to complete. Okay, so again, we had a very large sample, and we collected data over our multiple sites. Our age group, our average age again, so this is very similar to this sample that we talked about previously. It's a little bit bigger of a sample because we're only using one measure. And then we have our two age groups, so 5 to 7 and 10 to 16. Oops. 5 to 7 and 10 to 16. Okay. And again, our contrast group is almost 100 kids, and these are children whose parents have identified them as having a concern about behavior problems. Okay, so what we did was we first looked at group age and group by age in an overall analysis. We had no effective age. Okay, so in red, I used our nice fall colors, even though it doesn't look like this at all in San Diego. We have young children and older children. So yellow is older and red is younger. Again, young is 5 to 7 and old is 10 to 16. We had no overall effective age. We had no age by group interaction in spite of this, something that looks a lot like an age by group interaction. That's something we need to look into further. But we do have an overall effective group. So what we did was we followed this up probably inappropriately by looking at the age groups separately. And this is the same data, but we are looking at the effective group overall. And so what we see in the younger kids, so in our 5 to 7-year-old kids, we see no difference in between the alcohol-exposed kids and the contrast kids, and both of the groups have more disruptive behaviors than the controls. In the older kids, we see differences at all levels, okay? So alcohol-exposed is different than contrast, and both of them are different than controls, okay? And again, the overall group is significant. So if we go back here, what it's telling us is that the alcohol-exposed kids are showing elevations in this specific problem behavior, whether they're young or old. Okay, so again, age is not really an important factor in this for this measure. In our contrast kids, the interaction is not significant, but this, to me, it indicates that the younger kids the parents of the younger kids are reporting more problem behaviors than the older kids. And we just need to figure out examine this further to see why the interaction is not
significant. But Sarah, wouldn't it be likely that, or maybe I'm, so if you're younger when you go in to be seen, could it be that the problems are more significant just because they're being brought in by their parents
identified earlier?
Younger?
It's possible. We don't know when these kids could have been in the study previously. It's possible, although that's varies from site to site. It's possible, but then wouldn't the same thing be true in the alcohol exposed?
Well, would it?
I think so. I mean, to me, because of the way we recruit our subjects, for the most part, they're clinical referrals, so they're coming in because somebody thinks they're having a problem. So I would expect that a younger kid would look more like this.
But we're all, and I'm just thinking out loud, but it seems like if the bulk of our kids are adopted because they've been taken away from the birth family and because the parents think that it has something to do with alcohol, maybe we would see them younger or older regardless, but the kids who are coming in just because the biological parent or the birth parents presumably start seeing problem behaviors at a younger age, it might be that they're more severe and problems that start a little bit older.
That's definitely, that's definitely a reasonable hypothesis. I'm looking to see if we have any information on here. No, we didn't break down the, overall IQ score based on young versus old. So that would be one way, just a quick way to look at that. Are the kids in the younger this group here? Are they more impaired overall? That would be, you know, that's a, definitely an interesting follow-up question.
Okay.
Okay, so we talked about that.
So yeah, I have a quick question.
Yeah.
Just refresh my memory. Are you going to be collecting these same tests later in those young kids with third run?
It's not a specific aim of the study to test them twice in the behavior project, but we could. We also have, and I didn't mention this, we have this questionnaire on some kids, not all of them for sure. We definitely have multiple time points, at least in our San Diego data, and I believe we could have it in the Atlanta data set, that we would have multiple time points, and that would be an important follow-up analysis as well to see whether we could show the same thing in the same child over time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
And then one other quick question, and I can't remember if you're doing this or not, but getting some measure of puberty?
We have that. We do have that.
Okay. But no, do you? What do you have? Like
have
just
the
Tanner's?
No, we have, well, we have the questionnaire.
But the like a Tanner's questionnaire.
The self-report questionnaire, yeah.
Okay, because I know that we are at in L.A. and in Minnesota, we're collecting pubertal hormones. That's part of Christina Eubin's
right
project. One other question I have is, you know, are all of these analyses are being done, you know, by splitting young and old, not age continuously?
Right.
So I'm just wondering if that could be a tiny bit artificial, and, you know, knowing that whether a kid is 5 or 7 might tell you more than knowing whether they're between 5 and 7 or, you know, 11 and whatever the older age range is.
Yeah, we could look at, within our age groups, we could look at age as a continuous variable.
Yeah, and because, like, you know, we've discussed before that some of the kids, you know, our data might look a little low compared to the other sites, but some of that had to do with the age, not whether or not the data was good or usable. So I'm just wondering if that could increase the sample size a tiny bit if you include some of the kids we studied that were maybe a tiny bit older than your cutoff.
Yeah, I don't think we would have enough within that age gap. I think there were only 6 kids in your sample that didn't meet the age criteria, and the other, and so there wouldn't be enough kids to fill in that gap. But I do think that within the San Diego data overall, we could look at a broader age range and look at age as a continuous variable.
Right, and you could probably include the data from our sample as well. I mean, I'm not saying we're going to completely cover the gap, but you might have a little more power in age by group interactions if you look at age continuously rather than just lumping them into child or adolescent.
Yeah, that's a possibility. Okay, so to wrap up, so these are the conclusions for this study specifically, but they're not all that different from the conclusions of the previous study. I mean, overall, we're not seeing huge effects of age, suggesting that the effects that we saw previously in our older groups apply to the younger sample. So we're seeing the same types of deficits across both the age groups. The disruptive behavior specifically appear to be a sensitive measure. They're identifying kids with heavy prenatal alcohol exposure, and they're also specific in that older age group, in that we can use them to distinguish the alcohol exposed from these contrast group. And so I think that's an extra bonus result from this study as well. Just specifically to the disruptive behavior study, because we know that the disruptive behaviors are occurring in both the age groups, we would suggest that early intervention in that area would be especially fruitful. But getting back to what Kathy said, I think that would, so her question was whether we examine just the kids with disruptive behaviors and whether we could predict which kids had disruptive behaviors and which kids didn't. And we have not done that, and I think that would be a really important follow-up study to look at, and especially in relation to intervention, because, you know, maybe that's the wrong intervention for some of the kids. So I think that's everything I have. I'm happy to answer more questions, or if you think of anything else, I know we have other things on the agenda, but I'd be happy to answer any emails. And, of course, I'll come back and share additional findings when we have them.
Thanks, Sarah. Does anyone have any other questions? Okay, so the next item on the agenda then is just getting updates per project. So, Sarah, since you're on board, did you have anything else you wanted to add in terms of updates?
Me?
Yeah.
I don't think so. No.
Okay.
I think we've been just, you know, plugging away, and we have, you know, lots of kids tested, and we're specifically targeting our younger samples. Those are not quite as strong as the older samples, but we're everyone's making good progress in that area.
Okay. Elizabeth.
Yeah, so I think we're making good progress on data collection. And I think we're probably starting our time to longitudinal component. And we're working on, so we've you know, measured quality of data, whether it's usable or not, at all sites for the T1-weighted data. And, Jeff, maybe you could chime in. I know you're looking at the DTI data from your site before you add the other sites, but it's a little bit harder to judge usability of the DTI than it is structural, because structurally you can see these rings that show the kid was moving. So, you know, one other thing that I'll point out is that in all of the tallies for the brain imaging data from all the sites, we are counting a subject done once we get the data in the lab. We're not, we're not discounting the sites for having a kid move during the scan. I mean, informing them, yes, so that they can try to remedy that. But so the numbers in the imaging look very different in some cases from the numbers in the neurocognitive battery that Sarah is doing. And I just wanted to point that out as something as a group collecting the data. We should think about, you know, how much data do we need to really answer some questions, given that inevitably when you're dealing with kids, you're not going to get a perfect data set, whether it's neuropsych or imaging, from every kid. So I just think we need to think about that as a group. Like, for example, in the data that Sarah just showed, really interesting stuff, but there might be kids from some sites that she's not counting because they didn't meet very strict specific criteria for, you know, having 85% of the data in the database or not. So anyway, I just want to point that out as something that we need to think about, whether we need to think of our data collection progress as being every single piece of data is perfect for every single participant, or whether we can examine a lot of pertinent questions relative to our different aims in the various projects. So anyway, just a soapbox, I guess, that I've been on. Any ideas, thoughts?
Dr. Saul, this is Jill. And if
hi, Jill.
Just have you or someone from your team get in touch with me. We can finish off the charts for the time to Google Docs.
Okay.
That would be great.
Sure. I'll have Trin contact you.
Okay. Any questions for Elizabeth or any input? Jeff, do you have anything to update?
No real updates. This is maybe not relevant to everyone, but to the imaging sites, we are still working around an issue of a scanner upgrade that we have coming in March, and we've actually made some progress on that. It looks like we may have the possibility of moving to another, yet another Siemens 3T. So we may actually be scanning our time two kids in the hospital because our scanner is going to be upgraded in a major way.
You're going from Trio to...
It's an identical Trio. It's just a different location.
But I mean, your upgrade is going to be from Trio to Quattro or...
To Prism. Prism.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
Which will be very different, and we can't use it. We, in fact, already moved once from one scanner in one room to the next room over when they upgraded one of our CTs. So this will be our third scanner if we do this move. And that's still in the works, and that may happen sometime in March. And obviously, Elizabeth, I'll be talking to you more about that. But that,
I'm glad you have some options.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, we should definitely talk about that.
Okay.
Other than that, everything is going smoothly in terms of the neurobehavioral project and data collection.
Okay.
And Ken is coming to, for those of you who weren't on the call at the very beginning, Ken is coming to Minnesota this week to see 62 kids.
And we also are trying to schedule a time for Ken, but we don't have 62. Sorry, Ken.
That's
all right.
Ken, do you have any updates for us?
Well, two of my updates
have
just been mentioned. We're going to Ukraine, next week we're going to Ukraine. And to Minneapolis this week and sometime in the not-too-distant future to L.A. I think that the telemedicine thing, I'll just mention that a little bit because I think that that's moving ahead quite well with Jeff and his group in Minneapolis. As I think most of you are aware, we have given up pretty much on doing telemedicine in Ukraine, and now it's even more of a problem because the companies that make the telemedicine equipment refused to go into Ukraine. So we really have put the Ukraine thing on hold at this point and maybe forever, but we are moving forward quite rapidly as far as developing things in Minneapolis. And we are we've finished phase one of the process, which is for the folks in Minneapolis examining a child and then at a later date and then sending me the examination and then having me examine it at a later date and then sending back my comments about it. We finished that because it works out. It's working very well. And now we have to move towards doing it live, and we've got the equipment pretty much ready to be purchased. And sometime in the next 2 or 3 months, I haven't talked to this to Jeff about this yet, but will on Friday and Saturday, in the not too distant future, we'll be purchasing that and moving the equipment to Minneapolis. So I think we're moving forward rapidly.
Good. Any questions for Ken? Okay. Neither Tatiana or Peter. Leah, did you have anything you wanted to add from that project?
More excited about going to Los Angeles and getting some more images. Tatiana has the money for getting more samples for GWAS, and as soon as everyone's done updating for the month, we're going to remake our list and hopefully send that out in the next few weeks.
I remember Peter and Mike wanting to bring their little 3D camera.
Yes, I connected Mike to Trent, and he filled out. I assume he filled out the Google.
Yeah, so that's still in the works.
It's a possibility, yes.
Okay.
So yes, Mike would bring the small handheld camera that he brought to the meeting that we had in March, and we would compare images and results from the small camera to the big camera that we have.
Okay. And he wouldn't consider going to Minnesota. I guess that's kind of short notice now.
I don't know that they take, just because Ken is seeing 62 kids, I don't know that they're taking 62 images of the 62 kids.
You have a camera there, right?
Right.
Right. We're taking them as we
go. Right, so LA is going to be the option for that, I guess.
Well, no, actually Claire, they usually schedule 50 to 60 kids when we go to Atlanta. So that would be his second. I mean, that would really be his first choice, but I think he wants to get this done sooner rather than later.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. Kathy or Scott?
We don't have anything too specific to report. We're on the agenda for next time, so I think I'll just save my comments for then.
Okay. And neither Johan or Deepak are on the call. Is that correct?
Deepak is here.
Oh, hi, Deepak. Any updates for us?
The work which I was doing was going forward. I'm still waiting to get the samples from Tina. Tina is supposed to send me some samples which haven't got yet. And I'm also waiting for all the salivary sample I'm supposed to get from three different centers. So I'm more waiting rather than really doing too much work, because I need the samples to work on. So that's the progress.
Deepak, I have a question for you. This is Jeff. We do have your cortisol samples, saliva samples, at minus 80. But our plan is to collect some more when we have these kids here on Friday and Saturday of this week. Do you have a limit to how many of those you want, or do you want them as many as we can collect?
I think, doing the assay is not a big deal, so I would rather have a good number to have a statistics rather than a small number.
Okay.
So go ahead and do whatever you can.
Okay. Well, we'll send you the batch then, the complete batch, after this weekend.
Okay, sure. That'll be great. Thank you.
Sure.
Okay, informatics, Bill?
Nothing much. There was a little bit of chatter back and forth. There was a question when we talked about the data use agreement or the data sharing policy about would FASD researchers be held responsible for external collaborators who use data doing something bad with that data? And the answer was, Bill Dunty came back and said the answer was no, we would not. So I think that opens us up to pretty much finalize the data sharing policy as we have it. And so that will be kind of coming around, I think, soon for everybody to look at. But other than that, not that much.
Okay. So you're going to send it around one more time, and then it should be ready for uploading?
I think we're pretty close. Every time I send it around, there's a couple of
one more thing.
I think we're getting to the point where we're about ready to call a stop to it, and I think it's pretty good. It's been a lot of great comments from everybody, so it's improved it tremendously.
Okay. Tom and Kathy, anything to add?
Sure. Just quickly, as I mentioned at the at the outset, NOFAS just held its 25th anniversary event and had Dr. Kube and Dr. Warren there. I think it was a good opportunity to have Dr. Kube sitting with some Washington folks who know how important the FASD issue is. And we're continuing to do, many of you have already done webinars for NOFAS. We have a webinar series, and we've got Michael, Sarah, and Nora still coming up in the next 3 months. And so those have gone very well. We've had terrific attendance for those. And then I think surprisingly, two or three times the number of folks who have tuned in live have then downloaded them from our website. So getting a little attention for those presentations. And you know, Kathy continues to make Kathy's going to be in Europe next month and still doing 2, 3, 4 presentations per month with a major focus on all the work that you're doing. So that's about it. Do you have anything else?
No, that's it. Yeah.
Great. Okay. Did I miss anyone for updates? I think then the next thing we need to address is our face-to-face meeting dates. And so Jill has a doodle poll, and it sounds like there's some problems with trying to find a time where people can make it. So, Jill, you wanted to talk about this? Are you on mute?
Hello?
Jill?
Yeah, sorry, my phone cord popped out.
So I've got the doodle poll up here so you guys can see. And if you go to the left of your name, there's a little pencil, and you can click that. If you guys can all just take another look at this and see if there are some popular dates in here, but there's no section of three, and we need 3 days. So just take a look at maybe some that you marked no for and see if you can make it a green, if it's at all possible. So if you can take a look and do that in the next 2 days, and I'll send an email out to the group, I'll try and narrow it down to at least two choices by Friday, and then we can figure out when we're going to be meeting next in Rockville.
Can you resend the link, please?
Absolutely.
Ditto.
No problem.
Okay. Dr. Jones.
Hi.
For some reason, I didn't.
Jill, I'm trying to look at this real quick. The print's really small on my screen. Are there windows of time that look better than others at this point based on the number of checked boxes?
It's really hard because there's no sequence where it looks like a triplet of three dates together look good. So if people could just kind of look and see if they can just really make sure that all the ones that they have read are absolutely out for them in the next 2 days, then I'll be able to hone in on kind of the best looking ones.
Okay.
One other item that we had from our last call is the publication policy documents. Those are all up on the web, and so the whole process is up there outlined, as well as the forms for any kind of proposals. Has anyone taken a look at that? Has anyone used it? Had any issues with it or played around with it? Not yet.
Does everyone remember how to get to the secure section of the consortium website?
Always worth a review.
Okay, so I'm on the website right now, and there's this little thing that you click on. You click here, and a box pops up. I've already done it, so I should have logged out and taken you through the process, but a box pops up. The username is CIFASD. The password is consortium. And then once you do that, it gets you to this website right here, which this is what it looks like, and we did not remake this when we redid the rest of the website. So if people have time to kind of look at this in the next month and let us know what things do you actually look at in here and which ones can we move, what can we add to make it better. Now, this is just the part of the website that's just for us. It's got the password protection, so this isn't for the public. This is just for our use. And let Jennifer and I know, that would be really helpful. But as far as the publication policy, we went ahead and put it over here. And the PDFs explain the policy. And then when you click on, if you have a concept proposal to submit, you click on this, and it gets you to the Google form, which allows you to just fill in these fields. And once you hit submit, both Jennifer and I get an email telling us that someone has submitted something, and then we will be able to move it to the form that everyone can look at if they want to see the different proposals that are going on. And at the start of each conference call, the whiteboard that you'll see on WebEx will be the proposals that we've received that month.
So, Jill and Jennifer, I had a question. So I went in and looked at it and made some edits on a fake document that you guys had created. Do you also get an email about those edits?
I didn't.
Do you, should the person whose proposal it is get an email maybe? Because you had created a proposal, or maybe Jennifer did. I just added some comments to see if the comment, how that process worked. And I just didn't know what happened after that.
They weren't. You made comments on the proposal.
Right, you had a proposal.
Okay.
You had a
Right. We had just kind of a little right. We were playing around with it. Right. I don't remember seeing that, but I'll have to go back and check to make sure that process.
Because that would be, you know, you would want the person who put up the proposal, right, would want to get some feedback, or maybe they just need to know to check it.
Right, and there should be a notification, so I'll have to go in and check the settings on that.
Right.
Okay.
Oh, here's Sarah. Here, I can see your comments now.
Mm-hmm. Right, but you'd have to go in and check to see what those comments, right?
Right.
So I'll add
that. There's notification. We can do that pretty
yep.
easily.
I'll add that to my to-do list and make sure that I notify the author when there's been a comment each month.
Okay.
Okay.
So if
okay.
you go back to the web page, yeah. So on the left side, and Bill Dunty caught this. There's a CFAS publications policy and publications acknowledgement. Some of that stuff probably has been built into the new policy statement on the far right.
It absolutely has.
It has. Yeah.
We did. So it's here. It's over in the publication policy. So the acknowledgement text is right here.
Right. That's what I thought. So maybe the links aren't necessary on the left.
Right. Those are definitely things that we'll want to delete.
Okay.
Definitely. Yeah.
And so that would be great if everyone can just take a look at that secure site and kind of make a list of probably the things that you use so that we can get rid of things that we don't really need anymore and clean up. You know, we did the overhaul of the public site before, but now we want to kind of work on this end of it as well.
There might be things, Jen, that we don't necessarily use
mm-hmm.
but need to stay, right?
Right.
So you could just promote, I guess, make bigger somehow the things that are more commonly used, but leave the, I mean, I can't think of an example right now, but something that we don't want to go away necessarily, but we only rarely use.
Right, right.
Some sort of informational piece.
Yeah, Jennifer, would you have any metrics on how many hits these links get, or is that not collected?
I should be able to get that information from eJungle.
You might be able to generate a short list of things that we can then look at and say, no, keep that.
Right. That's great. Good idea.
It's Michael. I have a quick unrelated item, which is we should be thinking again of a CFAS symposium for the upcoming RSA meeting. Usually those are due in December. We have a little time to think it through. I'm happy to help organize it. Last year's was on sort of molecules to genetics, and I think it ended up being a very good symposium. And I do think it's important for CFAS to have a presence at the RSA meeting in a symposium just to differentiate ourselves and give ourselves more visibility, especially as we come up again on our renewal. So anybody who has ideas, just send them my way, or if you want to organize one, please go ahead and do so. But again, I'm happy to help out.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of something that hasn't been explored yet, but maybe we're in a position to. And I wonder if it could be centered around diagnosing at younger ages. You know, that could involve cameras, that could involve neurobehavioral. Just a thought.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Could tie in the DSM information in there too.
Right. We could put also some of the molecular markers into that as a sort of a starter, you know, anything that we're coming up with that looks good that way.
Okay. Well, thanks, Michael. And anyone can send your comments to Michael. Does anyone have anything else that they wanted to bring up in their last few minutes here?
This is Bill. If you anticipate having carryover, you just give me a send me an email or contact me as soon as you can, just to let me know that requests may be coming in. That'd be great. Thanks.
Anything else, Science Advisory Committee?
Nothing from me, thanks.
Nothing from me.
Okay. Well, thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Thanks, Jennifer.
All right.
Thank you, Jennifer.
All right, we'll talk to you soon.